Bloomberg on the Economy with Mike McKee and Carol Masser. Listen on demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Now available free for both iPhone and Android devices.
He's David Kotok. He's Chief Investment Officer at Cumberland Advisors. So, David, no surprise that we're here in terms of waiting for Washington to do something, come across with anything?
No, I'm not surprised. A happy New Year's Eve to you, Carol.
To you too, David.
Not at all surprised. I'm actually talking with you on the radio on Bloomberg and have a muted Bloomberg television screen on at my desk, looking at a countdown of 13 hours, 56 minutes, and so forth. And this is our American way. This is how we do it. Most of the country's more involved in a football game than what went on in Washington last night. It's the nature of the beast.
That's terrible.
Yes, of course it's terrible, but to paraphrase the quote from Churchill, which is not really Churchill's quote, I've learned that he attributed it to someone else, we are the worst system of government except for all the others, and that's where we are, and here it is. We're a living example of it, watching it unfold before our eyes.
You know, maybe I'm feeling, I don't know, a little nostalgic. I don't know. I was up in Hyde Park looking at FDR's family home there and thinking of the days during the Depression and all that he had to deal with, set up and resolve, dealing with the war and so on, and meeting with Churchill there, speaking of Churchill, at his home there. You know, politics has really gotten messed up, and at this point, there's no hope to see any kind of fix. Do we get, you know, even when we finally get the lawmakers to get together, David, are we going to get anything that's really substantial, that really makes a change in the system? Because I do feel like we're at a point where we need to really address some very, very important issues.
Well, American history is very revealing. I've been a student of it for all of my adult life. And you see the following. When we get to a crisis, war, disease, as some form of very serious crisis which builds and then reaches a crescendo, it galvanizes the country. Right now, we don't have a crisis. We have hand-wringing about deficits and debt, and the 10-year Treasury yields 1.7, or whatever it is today.
Right.
We have hand-wringing about the economic recovery, the threat of recession. If they don't pass the fiscal cliff, we'll go back in the tank. And the S&P is almost 1,400. If I recall correctly, that's a double from the low of March 2009.
Which says what, David?
Well, it says that if the U.S. economy is a marvelous, entrepreneurial, resilient machine. And when left to its own devices, most of the time, it really does well. And we are a wonderfully free people. We have great institutional stability. We change governments without tanks and guns. We have other problems with guns, but not changes of governments. So the nature of the United States and its economy and its activities and its institutions are so durable that we do very well in spite of the lunatics we elect to government, not because of them. They would like to say we do well because of them, but it isn't true. We do it because of the fabric of our country. Now, if we threaten that long enough and deep enough, then we may undermine a future for my children and grandchildren. I'm too old, so for me, I'm okay.
You know, what's interesting, though, David, you've probably heard it a million times, where, you know, markets, investors tend to like where things kind of, nothing gets done in Washington. But is it different this time around? I mean, we've got programs that are bankrupting the government, essentially, if they're allowed to continue at the growth rates that they're on at this point. We've got a healthcare system that is costing us dearly on many, many different levels. So, I mean, is it different this time around? Or do you investors really want to see where politicians get nothing done?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. You know, suppose we were to have a system in which the politicians had 60 days to meet. I think the Texas legislature works that way. You've got 60 days to to accomplish everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then you must come back 1 year later, unless there's some emergency that requires the legislature to act. Well, you know, I wonder if it would be a different system. We've created a professional political class. We've gerrymandered the congressional districts so that I think there's only 35 competitive congressional seats.
Mm.
That drives both sides to their extremes. The center of politics is disappearing in the U.S. each election cycle. And that's the nature of the beast that we have. But what happens? We go on. We create additional jobs, employment. We complain about this large health care cost, and it's a rising burden, and it's going to bankrupt us. Gosh, you hear that 100 times. On the other hand, the United States delivers some wonderful health care to people and keeps them alive and active. I'm an example.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are two sides to this. When you have 17% of your GDP going to health care, sure, a lot of it is wasted. And the other part of that is there's a lot of people who come here because the health care is so good.
David, you put out a note on December 27th. It was a letter to John Boehner. And you said, please do not do it. Please do not call the House of Representatives back into a year-end lame duck session. Would you rather just let the new Congress deal with this?
I would. I think we get to the new session. This would be my preference, of course. And then you have accountability in the new Congress,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to this end of lame duck, lame Congress, which has a terrible reputation.
I like that.
Tell us how
I like
feel.
That end of lame duck, lame Congress.
But Carol, if I can, a question, because Dom is still on and Kathleen mm-hmm. is still on, and the question is, everybody says we need a TARP moment, a 700-point drop in the middle of a failed decision politically,
yeah, let's,
in order to galvanize and get a decision. And so I have a question for two experts who are following this closely as journalists. Do we need a TARP moment? Is this an expectation which is keeping people from investing in markets and creating a great buying opportunity? For us, by the way, that's how we see it. We're fully invested here. But how do you see it as journalists? Do we need a TARP moment?
Dom, why don't you take it first?
I've been chomping at the bit to take this because every time I think about a congressional deadlock, I think back to those images of TARP votes and the split screen between the NYSE and the floor of Congress, where every nay vote that came up caused a 25-point drop in the Dow. And then it was only then that lawmakers kind of understood the gravity, the severity of the situation. So in some ways, as an investor, you kind of want to make people realize that there are consequences, but the question is, why can't people learn from those past mistakes? Now, TARP was a different...
We expect children to do
well,
that.
Well, you
not
expect
adults?
Him. But here's the problem. Why is it taken that kind of event to happen? And we don't know. TARP was a very different situation. Remember that. We were on the brink of a financial collapse if this does happen. The fiscal cliff is severe, but some would argue it's $600 billion worth of tax hikes and spending cuts, not nearly the kind of huge economic impact that if 10 different banks on Wall Street fail.
Fair enough, but it is enough that the Congressional Budget Office has said that if all of this takes place, that we could go back into a recession.
Sure, 2% to the downside.
Kathleen Hunter, weigh in on this. You cover Congress. I mean, are they waiting for that TARP moment for the markets to sell off, and is that going to finally get them into action?
I think on both sides of the aisle, among Democrats and Republicans, there certainly is a sense, although no one wants to come right out and say this, there certainly is a sense that the market's declining, market pressure after the first of the year, and when the new Congress after the new Congress reconvenes on January 3rd, would make it politically easier, particularly for some Republicans, to support a deal along the lines of what President Obama wants. I think that's definitely true.
Okay.
Carol?
It's sad that it has to come down to that, David.
Go ahead, David.
The point is this. Interesting. You know, we have 1,700 portfolios that we separately manage in our firm, a few billion dollars of other people's money. That's a sample. And in that sample, I get a sense of the fear of the repeat of the TARP moment, let's call it TARP moment risk index or something like that.
Right.
And my sense is the most recent memories are the things that drive the investing class. Therefore, they're standing on the sidelines.
Right.
That means this is an opportunity to buy stocks, not wait for the decision.
So, David, at some point we're going to get beyond this fiscal cliff situation, yes?
Well, we have to. We fall off the cliff, we hit our head on rocks, we go down farther, we face the debt limit fight. Obama wanted to tie a deal to resolve both the debt limit and the gap of $600 billion in some form. He didn't get it. The Republicans will not give that. I would be amazed if these negotiations bring in a debt limit resolution for a year or two, because the Republican position is harder and stronger in the debt limit fight. So they may be able to accommodate some compromise here. We'll have some tax increase. It won't be what Obama asked for. We'll have some extension of AMT with a fix, because they're not going to subject 30 million Americans to a new tax. So we can sort of get a sense of where this goes. It doesn't lead to a grand bargain. We don't get some permanent fixes. And my sense is that the nature of the American political system now is we never get permanent fixes. We're into these cycles.
Well, thank you, politics, correct?
Well, that's right.
And lobbyists. I mean, the system that's been created, it's funny, you know, over the holidays, I was with my whole family. I have a large family, lots of brothers and sisters, and lots of different political views. And it's interesting, but it all comes back to whether you're talking about the medical community and all the doctors who have to pay for their medical insurance and malpractice insurance and the lobbyists and the drug sector, like whatever sector, it comes back to lobbyists, because that's who gets our lawmakers back in their elected seats, and they represent them, not me, not Dom, not you. And the system is a broken one. And whether we need to go back to, or we need to create one terms for everyone, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, David.
Well, but it makes work for journalists who report to the world. You do, Carol.
No, fair enough.
We interface a lot. So, you know, it's true. People want to hear you tell the world what is happening. They want to hear Dom talk about a sector or a stock. I mean, Dom and I have done some things together in Bloomberg Television. And so look at all the activity. This is the Journalist Employment Act.
But there's activity.
There's activity. Job security.
There's activity, and then there's productivity. And I'd like to see more productivity.
Well, you know what I find interesting, David, and this is something that again, you mentioned before we went to the last commercial break. You talked about the numerous separate accounts that you manage on behalf of clients. And you said right now that you're about 100% invested in the market. What I'm curious about, though, is what exactly, how big of a cross-section or how big of a spectrum do you have with your clients with regard to their concerns about what's happening with our economy, about the fiscal cliff, and what steps are you taking, generally speaking, if you can bucket them into like two or three different groups, what exactly are people asking you to do, or what exactly are you doing in response to these client concerns?
Well, the second question is now something we confront. We manage a few billion in tax-free bonds towards income-oriented separate accounts. Now you get somebody, I'll give you a case study, you get somebody, a couple in their 70s, they've accumulated $5 million, they own $1 million house, they don't have a mortgage, they have Social Security, they have a little outstanding pension, and they had their $5 million deployed at an interest rate, safely, high grade, not junk, of, say, 5%. So they looked at themselves and they said, you know, we got $250,000 a year in income, plus we own our own house, plus we have Social Security and everything else. We can give gifts to our grandchildren. We can take trips. We can do this and so forth. All of a sudden, that $5 million prospectively is going to yield 2%, not 5%. They are now looking at income reduction. They view themselves as victims of financial repression.
Hmm.
They have high uncertainty about taxation. They don't know how to plan their estate. They don't know what to do with trusts. They go to their lawyer, he says, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what the law is going to be next year. And so they represent a few million households in the United States. And they hear the president attack them continuously. 250,000 a year and you're rich. These people certainly are well-to-do and are in the wealthy top decile in the country, but they don't view themselves as rich. They view Warren Buffett as rich, not the retired 70-something. And what do they have to do in terms of actions? They start to worry, I can't give charity. You know, we may not have it. We may not have the income. What do we do about grandchildren's gifts this year? Maybe we have to cut it back. That is at work in the U.S., and the impact of it is in the higher spending sector, which is why economically it's a small number of people, but it has a very large multiplier because they're the ones with discretionary income, and they're losing the discretionary income margin that enabled them to support their lifestyle. That's a psychological shift at work in America, and it's very big.
Huh. Okay. Let me ask you something, David. If we get some clarity, though, and maybe it is higher rates, which most expect that we're going to see higher rates for a lot of Americans, will that clarity, though, provide certainty so that wealthy folks, like the example you just set out, will still feel some certainty to take measures, to do spending, to give to their kids? I mean, is it the clarity that's lacking, or is it...
I think it's clarity that's lacking. Markets can take bad news or good news. They don't like no news. And if you give... Suppose we come out of this fiscal cliff negotiation and everybody... for whatever reason, agrees that the capital gains tax is going to be 20 instead of 15, and it's going to be made permanent, or the estate is going to be at $5 million with a 50% tax, or $4 million with a 40% tax, but it's going to be made permanent.
Well, permanent until what, the next round of...
Well, in the tax law without a sunset, like we've been through for years here, but a tax code change that would then require... lots of congressional negotiation to change again. So we would view it as permanent, or at least for a long enough period of time so we could depend on it. That would change things. You would see activity rise at once because everybody'd know the rules.
David, let me ask you, because I had a list of things I wanted to talk to you about, at least a dozen things. At the top was fiscal cliff, and we've spent 45 minutes doing fiscal cliff. So I do want to kind of move on and talk a little bit about the markets and investment strategy a bit, because Karen mentioned Borini, Laszlo Borini, and he's looking for the S&P to hit a record in 2013. So I think we're about 11% from the S&P record. We know the S&P has had a nice rally off that March 2009 low. It's more than doubled. What's your expectations for 2013?
Well, I'm in the same place.
You're looking at 1,600, right?
Next level for the S&P in our shop is a 1,600 target, and that is 2 years hence. That's at the midterm election resolution year. So let's think of it as 1,600 in 2014 at year end. Our target here was 1,450 sometime this year. We came close. And if you take that and say, all right, how do I get to that, and how do I get to a longer-term number of about 2,000 on the S&P at the end of the decade? It's relatively simple math. We've got a $16 trillion U.S. economy. We know what the profits are. We know what the interest rate outlook is. We have a low inflation rate. You put all that together, you say, I can translate those economics to earnings at the S&P. Call it today somewhere around $100 with a few dollars either way. We can project that growth if we did it linearly. At the end of the decade, the S&P is earning 135 or 140 or 130. A price level for the S&P from today to 2000 is a very reasonable expectation. Think of it as prices rising at a compounding rate of, say, 4 to 5% and delivering a rising yield starting at, say, 2 to 2.5%, total return 7%. You get these numbers very easily. You do not need big, robust economic growth. You do not need big windfalls. You just need a slow, steady, recovering U.S. economy, and we already got it. We got it in housing. We got it in the employment area slowly. We have it in the energy patch slowly, and we're going to continue to have it in spite of what the lunatics do in Washington.
So then how do you position yourself at this point as we wait for Washington to do something here, David?
Well, number one, if you're a day trader, you do other things. I don't know how to do that. What I do is take a few ETFs, package them up, and essentially get myself a representative diversified portfolio, and I emphasize sectors. So I've emphasized consumer discretion and housing, home building, the home builders ETF, which is not pure home builders. It also has the marketing side of it. I look for the U.S. economy to continue slow recovery, so I own a little transportation. You pick sectors and distributions with ETFs, which you can do very, very efficiently. The big issue is, what do you do when you have large bond positions and you now have compressing interest rates? We've got about $4 billion deployed. It's been a marvelous run in the bond market. Now what do you do for me lately? The client says, I'm facing a tax-free yield of 3 instead of 5. And what do I do in my pension plan? How do I meet my assumptions? By the way, this is true throughout the United States. This is, you know, CalPERS problem. It's the largest pension system in the country, and the individual account that has a small company pension, profit sharing, or IRA. What that means is households and entities have to move, these agents in the financial structure have to move allocations because they're not going to be able to generate yields. And the Federal Reserve has said, you're going to be this way for a while. And so we think that the allocation to the stock market is going to rise, and that's a big change after 12 years. That could be huge. And if it is huge, my numbers are way too low.
Sounds very bullish.
He's bullish. So is Laszlo Borini, yes. Right? I mean, we just heard Karen Moscow telling us about how Laszlo thinks that we'll hit record highs this year. He says, a few different things. One, yes, the housing recovery is helping out. Number two, the European financial situation is stabilizing in some way, that those European banks are gaining a lot in terms of their year-to-date returns. And number three, if you look at the overall picture for what's going to happen, the retail investor comes back in the marketplace for fear of missing out on the next rally. But, you know, David, that's all well and good. So let's take it on, put it all together here, because this is the time of year for resolutions. And investors and traders alike should be looking to think about making some resolutions this time around. What is your advice about what resolutions investors, or maybe even traders, let's stick with investors. What should investors do this year or not do this year to make their financial health that much better for 2014?
Two elements. You must rethink your asset allocation because the climate has changed. We just talked about the bond stock choice. And the second thing is, in the bond piece, you now must not reach for yield by deteriorating your credit standard or buying junk. I'm watching that go on over and over again. The frustrated investor then sacrifices credit to get yield. When yields are very low, as they are right now, you got to go the other way because you're not getting paid for risk the way you were 3 or 4 years ago. You're getting paid so much less. And therefore, you have to raise your credit standard above baseline. And that means you have to go to the 2.75% tax-free bond instead of the 3.25% tax-free bond. That's a very hard thing for the investing class to do. So emphasize credit, 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 credit. Get paid, get paid, get paid, and allocate towards other asset classes like the stock market, real estate, if you know how to do it, other places. That's the resolution. Now, Dom, all forecasts come with a guarantee. You guys know this. Next year, we meet together, Bloomberg in New York. We have a little lunch. You repeat the forecast. I guarantee you I'll give you a new one.
That's pretty much as certain as you can get, actually.
David, what do you make of some of the groups that really were leaders this year? Financials just kind of, you know, blew it out of the park here. Consumer discretionary names. And then you had healthcare. Those were your top three major groups in the S&P 500. I was reading a story off the Bloomberg this morning about how the cost of options on U.S. financial stocks has fallen more than any other industry this year in an expectation that those stocks are going to extend their largest annual gain since 2003. Mind you, they're coming from significant lows if you look just at the equity trade, and they still have a long way to go to get back to where they were pre-crisis. Nonetheless, they've been a great investment play if you bought at the beginning of this year. Do you like the financials?
If I were in New York with you now, I'd say let's go pull a cork. We are overweight, all three groups.
You are.
We love them, and we still have the positions. And to understand, there's a very important piece here. The housing recovery, we are seeing rising housing prices in over 40 states. Mm-hmm. 3 years ago, they were falling in over 40 states.
Again, they're coming from significant lows, and they're not even close to where they were pre-crisis.
Nowhere near it.
So just perspective.
And so our view is we have an entire decade of gradually accelerating housing. What does that mean? It means that the asset which secured loans in the banking system, the pervasive asset, which was deteriorating, causing the banks to have to raise loan loss reserves, triggering the foreclosures, all the things that you've been reporting for years, has reversed significantly. Every time housing prices rise from one level to a higher level, a whole lot of financial institutions are now over-reserved for losses they will not occur. And so they are able to be stronger in terms of credit, reallocate themselves, and become more profitable. So I am very bullish on the banking sector, the financing sector, the regional banks and the big banks and the insurance companies. We own them all through ETFs. I think the housing recovery is a long cycle now. From a very low level, it's been beaten up enough. It's healing.
Mm-hmm.
And now add to it this wonderful change in the United States in the energy patch. And every time we create another job in the energy patch, I think I saw a study from the Financial Times that says the average new wage of a hire in the energy sector is $1,809 a week.
Mm.
So it's not an entry level.
Right.
It's a job that's created with a multiplier. And so we haven't begun to see what happens when the United States, the energy sector, continues to expand, our current account deficit and our imports decline. We change the entire global picture in favor of our country.
It's a hugely bullish story. You almost make me forget about the fiscal cliff.
Oh, let's forget about the fiscal cliff. But we're also talking about the fiscal cliff is a cliff for a reason, because it's there and it's sharp to fall over it. What David's talking about right now could take years, if not decades, to develop in terms of the energy market here. I want to get back to something really quickly, though, David, about the financials that you were just talking about right now, because as we talk about the financials, they are the best performing sector in the S&P this year. They're already up about 25% as a group. What's the next catalyst, though? Is all of this already baked in? What's the next thing that gets those valuations even higher, even maybe above book value for some of the big banks?
I think we're going to see this. Sequential quarters of improving earnings, and suddenly market agents are going to say, wait a minute, this could be a very long recovery cycle in financials. And therefore, I need to take my weights up. And having been pounded, as you know so well, Dom, for years, this is an under-owned sector. The insurers are too. So we think there's a huge play in financials, and if you think about where the U.S. is in the world order, that's a big piece for us.
Listen to Bloomberg on the Economy weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York, or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.